California with the station and some stuff. So they've been working on it, getting the bugs out, and they had some things go down earlier. So hopefully I sound good to you. I hope so. And we are a little bit late, but we'll make it up at the end of the show. Tonight I thought we'd talk about issues and solutions about renewable energy. And, of course, this is your show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality. And renewable energy, I'm going to tie those together, believe it or not. If you're interested in participating in this talk, call 877-876-5227 in the U.S. And if you're over in Canada, try 888-815-9756. Okay, so let's talk about how is it that there is a spiritual, metaphysical connection to renewable energy compared to digging things out of the earth and burning them that were collected millions of years ago as a fuel source and taken off our planet, basically, so that we could eventually come to exist here. Now, here is the metaphysical, spiritual connection to begin with. If you go back millions of years ago, particularly about 55 million is when a lot of the coal and oil that we use today and gas, natural gas, was being formed. Now, some of it was formed all the way back to about 350 million years ago. So, you know, from 350 to 300, we had a lot. It was called the carbonaceous period. But that's one layer. But then there was another whole layer that came right after the dinosaurs were kind of gone, and it started to develop around 55 million years ago. So we had all this happening, and if it hadn't taken place, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases would have produced a very, very hot climate, one in which you wouldn't be finding human beings probably able to survive in. Yeah, and it would be a very wet world. We'd have to be living in the oceans for sure, because it wouldn't be much dry land. For those of you who've read the book or seen the movie Waterworld, it'd be something like that. So it would really not be a very comfortable place for any kind of human life to develop in. So if you're talking about a spiritual plan of any sort for the planet, you got to take all this stuff and put it out of the ground, into the ground. And a lot of it came from volcanoes that came from inside the Earth as gases and had to be re-sequestered inside the Earth through plant life and animal life dying and getting crunched down into areas where it wouldn't go back into our atmosphere. And that's a critical understanding of this. To understand when we're talking about non-renewable energies, we're really talking about mostly using these resources that were sequestered away from our atmosphere so we could exist. Now, think about this. Okay. We, for about 150 or so years, since the Industrial Revolution really got winding around, and somewhat before that, but not to any great extent, we've been pumping out a lot of greenhouse gases, particularly CO2, but there are other ones too. It is true that methane is produced by animals, and so even as we raised animals, there has been some methane produced, and all living things produce a little bit of methane. But that really wasn't the critical element, because the total quantities, although methane is a lot more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2, but the quantities were never all that severe. It's just now adding them together that it becomes a problem. And so the CO2 has been probably the biggest issue. And the CO2 has come from burning fossil fuels. And we are starting to turn the clock back. We're making our planet like it was 55 million years ago. Well, the problem with that is that we wouldn't have been able to survive very well 55 million years ago. And the kind of animals and things that were able to survive wouldn't have been all that friendly to us either. So we have to consider that that isn't the world we really want to go back to. And spiritually thinking, the construct of our world was to eliminate some of these really nastier creatures and make a world that's better for humans. And it took millions of years to produce this, but we could turn the clock back in literally dozens of years from this point forward and fewer than a couple hundred years from the time it really started to catch on. So we do have to be concerned that we are kind of going against the spiritual nature of the world. And it is our job to understand this. It is our job to see that there's a real spiritual mission behind the question of energy and how it's used and what kinds of technologies we're going to employ. Now, for people who say, oh, well, that's a bunch of nonsense, you guys probably aren't listening to the show anyway, but if you are, you can give me a call, either while I'm on the air or at another time, and we can discuss this, because I would like to explain more about the concepts than I can at the present moment. And I think that it'll make more sense if I went into greater detail. But, you know, for a lot of people who have already been listening, and I think that the majority of our listeners are people who have heard the show before, and sometimes the show on Sunday afternoon as well. We're already there in terms of seeing that there is a connection. Okay, what about the metaphysical issues? Well, metaphysics is a physics that we really don't completely understand, but it's there. And the metaphysical issues has to do with multiple dimensional issues. Our dimension of time and space is the one that is the most lethargic. It has the most amount of clogged energy, which we call material form. And gravity does its number on us in a very strange way. It creates something called inertia. And inertia is gravity that gets stuck kind of by form itself. And in other dimensions of time and space, gravity has a totally different role to play. And it has it's confounding physicists right now, because they think gravity is much greater in other dimensions of time and space. And actually, it's much less in some respects, depending upon how you look at it. So there's a lot of confusion about that. But at any rate, gravity is creating a lot of the issues that we are somewhat concerned about. Interestingly, gravity creates coal, oil, and, believe it or not, natural gas. And the weird part about this is that that's the force that is converting these substances into these rich energy sources that we are using. If it wasn't for gravity, they wouldn't be crunched down and made into a usable source for us. Most interesting, if you think about that. Even the stuff we find under the oceans, well, the oceans have a lot of gravity, and that's what's causing all the pressures to develop, and that's what causes, in the bottom of the ocean, a lot of hydrates to be formed, methane hydrates, and then also below that level, into the floor of the ocean, we have oil, of course, and we have other forms of natural gas. So it's a most interesting issue in the way that there's an interaction in metaphysical terms about how gravity functions in this dimension. In this dimension, gravity turns most energy sources that we have gotten used to using into a usable form of energy for us at our technological level. Now, if we were more advanced, the process would not be so dependent upon this. And if we were less advanced, we would have to be using something less rich in energy than coal, and especially than oil or gas, because those are hard things to get to. And we really didn't start using those until the beginning of the last century to any significant level. So it's, when you look at it, you say to yourself, wow, that's a big deal. Sure it is. Now, natural gas, it is true, it was used during the 19th century for lighting purposes, eventually for cooking purposes. But in terms of large amounts used to make electricity, which is really what it's predominantly used for now, that's a different issue. Now, now we're getting into mega uses of it in comparison to what was used during the 19th century. And, of course, oil was virtually not used at all during the 19th century as a fuel source. It was about right at the turn of the 20th century. Oil became a great resource, both as a diesel fuel and as a gasoline, which is a kind of refinement to oil, making it much more volatile, And, you know, all these things, and kerosene before that was used, but again, not very much, like in lanterns and stuff like that. And for a while, towards the latter part of the of that century, even in steam engines. But in all these cases, gravity was the big deal. And gravity is a metaphysical issue because it is the way that we are responding to it in our world and our universe, part of the universe in this dimension, that is so amazingly complicated to who we are. As we change our perspective on, we'll say, the finer points of metaphysics, we start to realize that there are other ways of creating energy and there are other ways of using energy that do not depend so much upon non-renewable, meaning it takes millions of years to make them, types of energies that are destroying the place that we live, you see. And so we have a different slant on things. Okay, so how in heck are we really going to make a difference then if we're going to be talking about renewable energy? And I want to make a note right now that I've already planned this. Today's show, we're not going to get through this in today's show, but I'm going to talk about it more on the Sunday show, which is on a, you know, it's on a different station, but, you know, we're kind of, it's kind of like the same thing. It's why life is, of course. But so if you can listen in on the Sunday show, I think what we'll be able to do is to go a bit deeper into these subjects, because there is just no way I can cover this subject. I'm not even sure I can do it in two shows. We might do the same thing next week and go into two more shows, because it's going to take that long to cover all of these issues and solutions. I want to start off with something that's big. We are facing an economic crisis. That part of that crisis is to also solve our energy crisis at the same time by the government financing both private sector improvements of housing and office buildings and schools, and as far as energy conservation is concerned, and possibly the building of renewable energy sources for those kinds of structures. And then the government sponsoring big things like wind farms and wave farms, which we're going to talk about next is the wave farms, and ways of, and also changes in the infrastructure of how electricity moves about our country. So it'll become more efficient. We waste 25-30% of our electricity by just transmitting it. Now, that's a big waste, if you think about it. And cutting down coal use and trying to find, which we have not yet found, an economical way to sequester coal emissions, such as CO2. And so these are all things the government is working on, our new administration under President Obama. And so it is important for us to realize then that we've got to put everything within this idea. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today, so that we can see who does what with what. And maybe all of you listening can then write letters or make suggestions, because, you know, unfortunately, I don't think the new administration has tuned in yet to this station or to me. I humbly believe that it's likely they're not listening. But if others are, you know, writing letters, et cetera, with us, we're going to write a letter. I'm the spiritual group I'm part of, where everybody's going to write a letter and do something. Maybe we could make some impact on this situation. I would hope so, because it might make a difference, and we'll keep our fingers crossed about that one. Okay, so here we go. Let's talk about a biggie, something I'm real excited about, actually, and that is the energy of waves. And you might say, why is he starting with that? That sounds so far out there, and, you know, well, because if you're going to really go after the numbers we need to make a change that will produce huge amounts of energy, I'm starting at the top. Believe it or not, the top is waves. It's not the, it's water. Water has, in its movement, has a lot more energy that it captures from wind and from solar heat than does the wind itself In other words, you can't really make a windmill that'll ever produce as much water as a turbine the same size would be inside a current of water moving, because the current of water has enormous amounts more energy in it because it's denser. And so it produces a lot more energy. And it's renewable because it comes from the sun. The sun produces the wind. Now, the Earth's movement also produces wind. Most people don't know this. It's a thing called the Coriolis effect. So we have wind created by the sun itself, which heats up the atmosphere, and that produces wind. And then the Earth spinning kind of adds to the effect. Okay. So we got something going on from the Earth, and we got something going on from the sun. So wind is a really cool thing. And so you could call wave energy a component of the Earth's movement along with solar radiation, solar energy. And it's kind of a neat way of collecting solar energy, because we don't need batteries or anything. There's always waves going on. Now, for those of you who are really into this wave thing, you know that the moon plays a role, too. It creates tidal effects and changes things. But, you know, the interesting thing about that, and I know some people have, you know, thought that that's the big way to make energy, is that it's a minuscule amount in comparison to solar, because the tides move based upon long periods of time over a whole day and then on a monthly cycle as well. And see, solar is continuous. Even when the sun goes down, you've got wind and waves going on. And so, because the energy in the oceans are stored, it's like a giant battery. And 70% of our planet is oceans. It's water. And water is good because it is a pretty good holder of the energy over a period of time. And batteries, in some way of storing electricity, has been a big deal for us. So having something that is pretty consistent, like waves going in and going out, and sometimes they're bigger and sometimes they're smaller, but they average, see. And you always have a little bit of the moon effect in there anyway. So you kind of are really picking up a lot of different angles from this thing. And there have been some experimental and somewhat, you know, in the Middle East, they actually have a wave energy system built. But, you know, the thing is that we need to investigate it a bit more to make sure we can do it in a safe way, so it won't literally break when there's very high energy currents in water. And it will produce enough energy when there's relatively low energy because of a lack of sunlight and a lack of wind. That can happen on occasion. I mean, we're always talking about the weather changing, and of course it could happen. But if you average it out, the amount of energy is so huge that if you build something that is two or three times what you need, it will always virtually work. So you can overbuild and then have enough to meet the highest peak levels of electric use at the lowest production levels. You can actually figure this thing out. And what it is basically, as a wave comes in and out, it can push against turbines, it can push against blades, like, you can think of different kinds of fans, and it could be like a fan that just has straight blades and run around in a circle like a squirrel cage motor, if you're familiar with those. Or you can have a turbine that looks like a regular fan blade, or you can have all kinds of unusual blades that run in kind of odd-looking things, but they all can produce significant amounts of energy because the blades then turn generators, huge generators, that then generate the electricity we're looking for. A generator is just, you know, magnets and copper wire usually, and it produces a huge amount of electricity. As a matter of fact, it might be able to use nanoparticled carbon wire eventually that will produce even more energy. Another day, another subject, but just so you know, we can even increase the efficiency of this whole thing. And might be able to make wire that goes across our country out of the same material. It'll be 10 times to 100 times stronger than copper wire, so it'll support more strength-wise, physically stronger. And it'll allow a lot more current to go through it. But you didn't hear about that, huh? Well, it's a new thing. They just came up with it. A new type of thin film layers, single molecular or a few molecules thick of a special kind of carbon, and it allows huge amounts of electricity to pass through it at room temperatures. You don't have to super chill it or anything like that. It produces almost no resistance. Wow. neat stuff. Okay. Now, I know some people are afraid of the word nano and all that, but these particles aren't going to get up and walk or shake your hand. They're just going to transmit electricity. These aren't the kind that get into, you know, into things and change everything. That's a different kind of nano. Okay, so, and we'll get to that part, too. That's going to be about the transmission issue. But for right now, I just thought I'd throw that in there, because if we're going to be producing a huge amount of energy, it's got to go somewhere, right? And I'm saying, hey, we're going to have some solutions for that. Now, what are the problems with this system? Well, the first thing is nobody's really built one big enough to make a significant dent. They've built some for like a city or a town in the Mideast, and they're supplying a significant amount of energy for those kinds of sources. But we're talking about something that would go, you know, down a quarter of our seaboard on either the West Coast or the East Coast, you know, in various, but not the whole seaboard, but, you know, when I say quarter, every few miles you might have one of these stations, or every 10 miles or 20 miles. And the amount of energy they could produce would be total. In other words, you could make, if you go to three sides of the country where we have water, in parts of the Gulf, there the waves are a little bit less strong, unless we have a hurricane, of course, and then you go to the West Coast and East Coast, you actually can produce enough energy to not only supply the United States, but supply both the North America and South American continent easily, all the energy they're going to use in the next 50 years. I'm kidding you. You can actually produce that much energy. And that's the thing that is remarkable, because it's a big ticket thing. We're talking about probably 5 to 10 years to build a few of these things. But boy, in the long run, it really looks good. What's another issue? Well, if we continue to have global warming, the seas could rise to the point where these things won't work very effectively, because you have to put them at a certain level, and if they're too submerged, they may not work properly. And they may get damaged, too. So we have to be concerned about that. And as we put more energy into our planet, we get super bigger storms that may also damage them. So we have to kind of reduce the effects of global warming, so that we can build these kinds of super mega kinds of electrical producers in the future, because we're not going to be able to build them next year, in 1 year or something like that. We could build a few, I think, smaller ones to prove their success in the next maybe 3 years. How's that? In 3 years, I think we could do that. Maybe build one, three of them, you know, one in the Gulf, one in the West Coast, one in the East Coast, and see how they do. Now, would you want to build super, super big ones? Well, that might be a little risky. Because if that super big one is supplying like a third of the country and it goes down, uh-oh, and if you're depending too much. So I would like to build more moderately sized ones, you know, like 10, 20, 50, 100 miles apart from each other, whatever it's going to be, whatever works mathematically. By the way, if you're expecting a break right now, we're not going to have one because we started a little late, so I'm going to go a little bit longer before we break. Just so you know. Okay, so let me continue. All right, that's a big deal. Now, who's going to pay for all that? That's got to come from government. Is this a super government project? Yes. I mean, of course, the private sector could be involved in it to some extent. Obviously, you'll hire companies, et cetera. But this is like the big government kind of solution. For the people who I guess are the more democratically inclined, socialistic kind, this might really look like a good deal. I don't know. I don't get into that. What I'm concerned about is whoever can do it is the best is the people who should be doing it. I don't think that this can be done by private sector. Why not? Because I think each one of these plants that produces this kind of energy, we're looking at maybe $10 billion a shot. And if you're talking about putting in 100 plants, you know, that would be $1 trillion or something like that. Let's say you're talking only about maybe putting in 20 or 30 plants. That's $200 to $300 billion. That's more than we could expect private industry to really go into. And so although it is a big solution, and I'm talking about, you know, the North and South America, not just the United States now. So we could go into multi-country kind of solutions here. They could all be located in the United States if we wanted that way, provided that we build an infrastructure that can reach out and get to everybody. I don't know that that's the best solution, by the way. But the point is that this whole thing could be kind of almost a worldwide project of getting us off of fossil fuels and into some really big kind of renewable energy. There are other kinds of much smaller wave generators. They use them right now that sit on a wave, sit out in the ocean, and as the wave goes up and down, the movement of that charges a little battery. It produces a little bit of current and a little bit of charging. And actually, they do this for buoys that are out there, and they have to have a little light going on and off. And actually, they can do that. It'll charge it. Some of those are not as efficient sometimes as just using a photovoltaic because, again, the waves move in and they move out, and sometimes you can't tell. And in one spot, you're going to get enough energy. It averages, and sometimes it works. It's not a bad thing for that kind of operation, but certainly you couldn't power a city with these kinds of things. You need something much bigger, and it usually has to be close to the coast because that's where the waves really break. As the waves move against the land, you get the energy changing from a kinetic form, which is like a potential energy, into an actual energy that's moving something because there's a force applied against the wave. And when a force is applied against the wave, which is the structure of the land itself, it converts itself into a usable energy source. It's a kind of physics thing. But at any rate, so most likely these things will be close in. What's another subject that I want to get into, and that is creating wind farms, but again, not necessarily on land, although that's a suggestion by Mr. Pickens, et cetera, and I want to get into that. But when we come back from break, we'll talk about what a wind farm would look like, and they're doing this off of the coasts in Europe, several places. They're building wind farms on the ocean. Why on the ocean is better than on land? Because outside of the United States, there's almost no place in the world that has a really consistent wind. And we've got a wind corridor, which is a good place to build. And maybe we can look at that, too, today. We should. But right now, I want to talk about this question of building wind turbines out, way out, into the oceans. And then we'll also, just to give you a little heads up, we'll also talk about putting turbines in big rivers, provided that they don't adversely affect fish and other things. We've got to talk about that. And these are all big projects. Then I want to deal a little bit today with some of the smaller things we can do, like photovoltaics and other things, and where we're at with that and how that fits into all of these other ways of generating energy that are renewable. Well, anyway, we are at that time now where I think we'll go to break. So we will be back, give or take, in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for a better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. I was just talking to our engineer about UPSs and batteries and generators and stuff. Okay, so here we are, and we are looking at big ways. The government, I'm starting from the big way side today, that we can produce energy. And I said before we went to break that wind farms on the ocean, in most circumstances, are more efficient than wind farms on land. Why is that? Well, the ocean doesn't have big buildings, and it doesn't have, and it has more consistent weather patterns that you could depend upon, and the wind is more consistent. So you have big winds that tend to be consistent, and that's what you like when you have wind energy being produced, and you can put giant windmills, really big ones out there, and even if they make a little racket in their noise or if they look a little strange, they don't bother people too much. You could almost get them even far enough out so that you can barely see them. Even when they're quite tall, like 100, 200 feet tall, you can actually still, they don't bother the view very much. So that's a good thing. And what are the problems with that? Well, it's a little more complicated to build a giant windmill farm when you've got thousands of feet possibly of water or whatever. It's better to do it on the shelf rather than go out into the deep ocean because you got to go so deep that it's almost impossible. But still, it could be done, and they are doing it. And then the other thing is getting the energy from the windmill back onto land requires a lot of cabling. And that cabling could be quite expensive and difficult. Because you got to run it along the ocean, the ocean is not exactly an easy place to have something like that in it, and they constantly need repair, and you have a saline kind of environment, and all these things go on. So it's not 100%, but they're doing it, and the cost per kilowatt hour is about 2.5 times that of coal that is not sequestered and that you just, all the gases go off to the atmosphere. About 2.5 times coal if it's done on a large scale in the perfect environment. If it's not done in the perfect environment, it could be 3 or 4 times more expensive. I didn't mention this, but if you have a wave farm, wave energy, that can be comparable. Believe it or not, it could be comparable to coal if you do it on a big enough scale. And that's coal that's not sequestered now. If you talk about sequestered coal, that's 60% more costly. And then it's certainly competitive to coal that's sequestered. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't sequester some coal. I don't want to get rid of coal completely. As a matter of fact, I don't want to get rid of coal necessarily at all because we're going to need it in the near term. I don't know that we need a 500-year supply, which is what we supposedly have or whatever it is. But I think we're going to need it for the next 10 or 20 years, and we need to be able to change some of these coal plants to be less dirty, but that means more expensive energy for us all. And I think that's something we're going to just have to decide upon if we're going to go that direction. Do you want your bill to be 60% higher for your power? That's about what it would cost to change over half of this country's energy supply, which is coal, to a form that would be sequestered, and they're not sure they can do it yet. It's sort of like, well, even if we can do it, it's going to cost 60% more, but we're not sure. And sequestering only gets rid of 90% of the pollutants. They still get about 10% that will go up, but that would be a huge improvement. Believe me, a huge improvement. Yes, half of our energy comes from coal, if you didn't already know that. Right now, in the United States, and if you go worldwide, it's pretty much like that too. And China's, I think, beyond that. They love coal, but unfortunately, coal does not love them. If you looked at some of their cities recently, so at any rate, okay. So we've got another solution here, possibly in the works. We have some issues with it. The other issue is giant wind farms can be hazardous to waterfowl and, you know, birds are flying around. And they also can even affect, you know, depending on where you put them, you know, the ability to use the ocean for shipping, et cetera. So you've got to be careful about how you build giant wind farms in the ocean because, you know, it has to be well planned. But we have the technology, we have the judgment, we have the skill to be able to make these decisions and do it properly. We could get probably 20 to 30% of the world's energy off of giant wind farms in our oceans. Yeah, that much. In the United States, we are blessed with a wind corridor, which is on the leeward side of the mountain, Rocky Mountains. And it goes all the way down into Texas, believe it or not. And, you know, somebody could say, well, wait a second, the Rocky Mountains aren't necessarily all the way to Texas. But, yeah, they are because of the way that the wind currents kind of blow around. It goes in the panhandle anyway. And at least through New Mexico, that's true. And when the wind comes over the mountain, which is a good thing, you know, having the wind come over, as it drops down, because, again, gravity is working in our favor in this thing, and you have the Cornelius effect, you get some pretty strong winds down this corridor, consistent strong winds. And so we could build wind farms up and down the corridor all the way to Canada, even into Canada. Canada has some really big mountains. You know. So, you know, if you go through Alberta, man, there's some huge mountains. I mean, that's the Rockies, but they're bigger Rockies than we have in some respects. Okay, so we could build wind farms. Now, what are the issues? The issues with wind farms are they're not real pretty, and some of them make a considerable amount of noise if you're very close to them. They concentrate a lot of energy in a relatively small area, but then you've got to put it into a grid system. And that grid system, unlike with waves, we can't do it every 10 or 20 miles. You've got to do it as the wind is coming in. Some places are windy and some places aren't, so you've got to kind of be where the wind is. You can't be, the ocean's everywhere, but you can't, the wind isn't everywhere. And there's some places in this wind corridor that are excellent, and some that are not so good. Also, it takes up land. I mean, let's face it, some of that area of land we use for other things, you know, and we may not be able to use it as much for those things if we have wind. Now, a lot of people say, well, you can have cows run around out there or something like that. Well, maybe, but what if you're using it for a golf course? I don't think too many people are going to want a wind farm in their golf course, you know. I'm not a golfer, but I'm just using it as an example. Or let's say you want it as a natural preserve for, you know, people who go hiking and so on. I think a wind farm would kind of dampen the moment. You know what I'm saying? So it wouldn't be something that we would all just jump on board with, and there would be some resistance to some of these areas that might be good wind places, but they aren't great for the rest of the folks. You know? So we have to pick and choose. And although about 20% of our energy can be produced up and down this corridor, I think reality puts it lower than that. Maybe 10 to 15% is what we can produce from wind energy. If you really have to face the truth about what people do or don't want, you know. And you could say, well, there's some places that are ideal. Well, then fine, we'll use those places. And there are other places that there'll be a lot of hassles with, and maybe we won't be able to use them. You know, maybe when you're skiing, you're not going to really enjoy looking at the windmill going, you know. And it does make noise. Even the quietest ones, under the best circumstances, you get close up, you're going to hear it. Because, I mean, you know, it's a giant turbine. It's a giant fan. You know, we know fans make noise even when we do little ones in our houses and stuff, right? So this is, unless they're going really slow. Now, they have gotten them to the point where they go slower, and there are new designs all the time that are less noisy and are more efficient. So we're working that one out. Now, this is another government big project. Windmill farms, whether they're out in the ocean or they're on land, are really too costly, too much of an infrastructure cost deal to be able to expect private industry to put this in. It's going to come again through, possibly this is a propitious time, through maybe our bailouts and all these other things that we're going to bail out ourselves now, finally. We have energy that we can afford, but energy that will also help the environment. Now, again, the cost here is about the same, but a little less, than a wind farm would be in the ocean. because you don't have some of the problems you have about putting them in the ocean. It's a more complicated arrangement. And provided you've got a good grid system, if you can connect them right into that, the cost is really, we could get down maybe much closer to the coal prices, certainly into the gas, natural gas prices range, if this thing were to be done really intelligently. And so there's a good source of energy. Now, you say 10 to 15% isn't going to solve our problems. No, but it's a collective thing. We can't really say that any one of these things alone is going to do the job. But we have to look at it from a bigger picture kind of thing of it all adding together. And hopefully we can make a difference. Okay, so those are kind of the big things. Let's talk about infrastructure change in terms of the grid system. We need to improve our grid system, probably changing voltages to higher levels. Frequencies may be different. And we also need to improve the efficiency of transformer use. And also I mentioned the wire. Copper is really probably not the best thing for what we want to do. Believe it or not, copper has a high greenhouse issue because although it doesn't produce any, greenhouse gases, to make the stuff, you got to go in and dig it out and all this other stuff, and it's not readily available. The mining is a big thing. I'm not saying to shut down the copper mines. I'm just saying if we're really going to do this, we may not even have enough copper. But they are coming up with new technologies. Carbon, which is everywhere. I mean, it's like everywhere you can look, there's carbon. And just the very thin molecular layers of carbon can transmit huge amounts of current. And we may find that, and it's a very, very strong wire. And we may find that is a way to build up our infrastructure and maybe use the existing lines, and just change them over to copper. Carbon. Wouldn't that be neat? And then take the copper out and recycle it and use it for other things where we need copper. I think that's really, really neat. And we might still have to use copper in some other parts of the system. But transformers could be much more efficient as well if they had carbon windings rather than copper windings, carbon nano windings. So this is a whole new element that we could improve. If we could, say, knock out two-thirds, let's say we're losing right now 27% of our energy through our grid system, that may be a little bit on the too positive side. I mean, we might be losing a lot more than that, but no, I don't think I really know for sure. But at any rate, 27%, and we could save 18 of it. Wow, that's like we generated 18%. Boom, that's what we saved. We conserved 18% of our energy. Huge, huge, huge difference. Wow. And to me, that's significant. That's more energy than a land-based wind farm corridor would produce in the United States, in reality. Remember, the 20% is probably going to be 10 to 15 because we're not going to like some of the locations that they, might want to use. So that's a good deal. That's a huge deal. And at the same time, we solve the problem about using wind farms and other things, which I'm going to mention, and using wave farms for getting energy. Wow. We can also use some of our bigger rivers, provided we are careful, to run generators. They're doing this in the city of New York right now on a pilot program. They have a couple of generators in the Hudson River, and they are literally generating electricity. As the currents go in and out on a daily basis, they're using somewhat the moon effect, but they're using other ones too. And as the water moves through the generators, it supplies energy to local stores. Tell me that isn't cool. Yeah. Now, we could do this in a number of rivers, the great Mississippi. We have many rivers in this country. And we could be using it that way. It's hydropower. It's just another form of hydropower, but we don't have to build a dam. We just put a generator in the river. Now, you have to be careful about fish and other wildlife habitat. That's an issue. And you also have to be concerned about, someone might be scuba diving. I don't know if too many people scuba dive in the rivers, but if they are, they could get sucked in. You've got to have issues about that and boating and other things. Fishermen might not care for them too much. Maybe they'll scare the fish away. We have to learn all about these things to be able to use them. It would be more locally generated for small towns and businesses in the vicinity. Probably not enough energy could be produced to just shoot it into the grid the way we're talking about mega systems. But it could add to the local energy needs. So it's something to consider, especially in some locales. We can be scoping these things out immediately, and then these things can probably be installed within a few months to a year. You could have a system running. The smaller the system, the easier it is to get it into operation faster. Now we're talking about something that is going to produce a lot of jobs right now. It's going to get people some energy right now. It might only be 1%, but 1% is 1%. It's 1% we didn't have. And we're running out of coal-fired energy. They haven't been building new coal-fired plants because of concerns about the requirement to sequester the outsourcing of greenhouse gases, which seems to be even a bigger plausibility with the new administration in place. And so many companies that build coal-fired plants stopped doing so about 5 or 6 years ago, and we are going to have an energy shortage like you can't believe starting next year. I'm serious about this. As much as 40%, we're going to have rationing. But that's another show. Okay. So here we go. What are some of the other things that we can do to make energy? Well, you've probably heard about some of the California solar panel and solar, they call it Helios, where you use mirrors to heat up a fluid to create energy. And the fluid could be anything from water to even mercury fluids and other things. But at any rate, you are creating energy from the sun on large scales. Now, what's the issues with those? Well, it takes up a lot of land, and some of the land isn't all that great, but some of it is, and it isn't all real pretty. The solar panels are not very efficient. Actually, a more efficient design, which is being used in Europe, does involve mirrors and heating a central point to get to be very hot and produce turbine energy. And that's been pretty effective. In other words, it's worked. But the problem is that you're about 4 to 5 times the cost of coal-produced electricity. So it's kind of expensive. So how would you feel if your bill was 4 or 5 times higher, your electric bill, and or your natural gas bill, putting the two in common place together, because they're both fossil fuels? How would you feel if those bills were 4 or 5 times more? Most people would say, you know, I'm really in favor of solar, but that isn't for me. I'm not going to go there. And then the problem is that if they go into the existing grid system, remember they're going to lose 20% of the power, 27% of the power besides. And that's already been figured into the coal, but it isn't been figured in on a lot of the numbers I've seen for these solar farms. That's kind of a concern, isn't it? Right. So it's expensive, and the panels last 20 to 25 years. They don't have a consistent life expectancy if you're using photovoltaics. Mirrors can last longer in some respects, but there are issues with that. They get dirty, they get damaged, they warp sometimes. There's a high heat factor. You got to be careful you don't fry people. But, you know, if we're going to get involved with this, I think we're going to have to find a way to make it much more efficient and cost-effective. It's great for places that have very high energy costs. They don't have any coal. They're paying for diesel or oil used to run generators, and it's costing a lot of money. Or they're paying for natural gas at a high price. Or they may be using liquefied gas, liquid petroleum gas. So there's a number of things. And then there's another kind of gas, you know, this compressed natural gas, which has another potential use. All these factors come into play. And if we look at it, and you can make compressed natural gas, by the way, out of coal, but the process itself produces a lot of, unfortunately, you got it, greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide. Tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide and some carbon monoxide. So unfortunately, you could take all this coal we've got and make it into a natural gas, but that produces more carbon dioxide, and you get it, what are you going to do with it? So there's an issue. Okay. So big solar farms are really not necessarily going to be the answer in the near future. I know that a lot of people would like to think that it's because it seems so, it seems intuitively like the right thing to do. You know, the sun's out there every day. Why don't we do something about it? Let's put it in the desert, collect it, and sell it. Yeah, it just that it hasn't been cost effective. And photovoltaics are we can't seem to get over the hump. Last few years, some companies, one of them was called Nano Solar. I don't even know if they're still around. I think they are. Over in Silicon Valley. They were coming out, we're going to have thin film solar coming out over years, hundreds of thousands of square feet of the stuff produced every month or whatever. And you know what happened? They could produce it in the laboratory, but they haven't been producing virtually any on a large scale, because when you try to make it, when you try to upgrade to the large scale from the lab, it turns out the product gets damaged, it doesn't work right, and they have too much failure, like 85% or something like that. It's a huge amount. And we have, you know, all this material being destroyed by trying to make it on a big machine with big rollers, et cetera. It just isn't working. Well, unfortunately, that's the nature of doing business. You have to be able to upscale. You have to take it from a laboratory to a huge production and be able to make sense out of it. And they're not doing that. So all this promised cheap solar panels made out of thin film, four-layer thin film technologies has not panned out yet. I'm really keeping my fingers crossed, because that could be the answer. If it were to come in at the watt price that they were talking about wholesale, we could make farms out of it that would be competitive with coal as it is today. Really. And I'm not kidding. But that's a big if. And it's been years now, and we just haven't seen it come about. Now, remember, you know, I'm kind of in this industry, so I know something about it, I guess. And what I'm telling you is very, very, you know, the truth, even though you don't like hearing it. I know. Everybody wants to believe that, the solar panels are great, and we're going to just stick them on our house, and we're going to... It doesn't work like that. The solar panels that are available right now are quite expensive. They have inconsistencies in their design. Some work better in the beginning of the life cycle. Some work better at the middle or the end. Some work better in full sun. Some work better in partial sun. Some work better, throughout most of the day, but they don't produce a lot of energy. So, I mean, you get all these kinds of issues. And those issues are going to have to be discussed, unfortunately, on Sunday's show, because we're running out of time. I remember, I told you, we were not going to get through this subject. I've got a lot more to tell you about, and I'm going to tell you what we're going to be covering on Sunday's show, if you can listen in. And that is, we're going to go into the question of solar, but for individual houses and buildings, and solar in other ways. We're going to talk about geothermal power. We haven't mentioned that virtually at all. Now, if we were Iceland, we probably would have started with that. But Iceland's got its own problems right now. Their banks failed a few months ago, and they're in big trouble. And then we also need to talk about other ways of generating power that I haven't even touched on yet, and also storage of energy, and a whole bunch more. So all of that has to come into play. But we are running out of time for right now. I do want to mention that, let's see, what day is that? It's on February 2nd. Mimi, a member of the spiritual group I'm a member of, is going to be talking about the etheric realm over at Borders Books and Music in Glendale. If you are in the area, drop in from 7 p.m. to 8:15 and participate at 7320 West Bell Road, if you know where that is. That's in the Phoenix area, remember. When I say Glendale, some people think it's California. It's not California. It's in Phoenix. That's where I'm talking from, although everybody else who's doing this show is actually in California. All right. And I just want to mention again, Sunday's show, very important. Remember, we're going to be doing part two of this show, so if you want to hear more, and there's a lot more to talk about, believe me, a whole bunch more, tune in 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 1170 a.m. if you're in the Boston, Massachusetts, Norfolk, Providence, Rhode Island area. You can just tune in to 1170. I'm on the air there. If not, if that isn't going to work for you, WDISAM.com radio. Yeah, just like you're listening to this show, you can listen to that one on the air. And so wherever you are, figure out your time, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, this Sunday, Listen in on Sunday afternoon, Why Life Is Live, and you can call into that show as well. We are out of time for right now. I hope this has been enjoyable to you, and I'll be right at you next week, same time, same station. Bye till then.